Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
25,000 California high school seniors may not graduate this year. They are special education students, and in the past, they haven't had to pass the California High School Exit Exam, also known as CAESE, in order to graduate. But this year, things changed mid-semester, and as Lyra Frederick reports, these students are left in the lurch.
Among the high school seniors expecting to graduate this year, Rochelle Stallworth is ready to walk the stage at Oakland High. But Rochelle is dyslexic, and after five attempts, still hasn't passed the high school exit exam.
For the last couple years now, all the other seniors got to pass. They got to walk the stage, even though they didn't pass the CAESE test. And for our class, it seemed like nobody cared about not helping us.
The small, slow-paced learning environments of special education classes are turning them into havens for a motley crew of students not succeeding in mainstream classrooms. School psychologist Mike Roach says this diversity puts a strain on teachers.
You could have within a class someone who is actually mentally retarded through a number of very different processing problems to someone who is high average or even gifted in one class.
But special ed students can succeed when they're offered so-called modifications. That's ed speak for things like calculators or have test questions read to them, all of which are okay in classrooms, but not on the exit exam.
This is my best friend.
Hi.
Yeah, she didn't pass the CAESE test neither, one part, but she's still smart though.
I am passing my math class, but with the CAESE, it's it makes it hard because, you know, when you sit there for so long quietly, it kind of messes with you.
This is my other sister, Kiana.
Did you pass?
Yeah, I passed.
She passed both parts. She's smart, but dumb in some ways.
Hard for me, and I only missed it from 6 points, I think.
Hold on, I passed too.
You got to get
okay.
Okay, I passed barely by 2 points from the math portion, but I still passed.
For the past couple of years, all California high school students have had five chances to master the exam. And when exit testing first began, educators say they saw a difference in their students.
I mean, when we first started, people kind of geared up, and our students, I think, were studying harder. But as the progressive administrations of the CAESE took place, and people felt like they kind of hit a wall.
Rochelle is one of them. She plugged along with the help of her grandmother, Margaret Boyer, who prodded her every step of the way. Extracurricular activities and recreational time evaporated while Rochelle focused on passing this one exam.
That one summer, I couldn't go anywhere. The whole summer I had to study for the CAESE test.
It was perfect. I mean, I didn't see anything wrong with it, you know, because she was doing what she needed to do.
If I want to go out, she'd be like, no, can't go out, so I got to be in the house, you know.
She didn't think it would help her. But it's hard for me to understand or to conceive that reading something and going over and over it, that you won't learn something from it.
Even on vacation, I had to study for her.
It didn't help her very much, I mean, because her score did not come up that much.
Mm-hmm. It was miserable.
She has tried so many times and just get so close, but yet missing it.
Mm-hmm. What's the slope?
So how can a special education student like Rochelle have a 3.0 GPA, get good enough scores on college entrance tests, and still fail the high school exit exam? Well, first of all, the SAT allows a calculator. And Rochelle tests relatively well on material that's actually covered in class before she's tested on it.
See, it's not so bad, is it? No.
After I took the test, a week later, the class that I'm in went over it after I took it. So I'm like, I don't get it. You're teaching me something that I just
you're going over something I just took on a test when you should have went over it before I took the test. You get it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I certainly hope you can cure my problem.
Let's try this.
This attacks their disabilities head on. There is no place in California for this kind of injustice, especially in a state where 64% of students with disabilities are also minority students.
Disability advocates like Joe Beam are concerned that 52% of special ed students fail the exit exams. She says this may indicate a larger civil rights issue. Her own son, Josh, is dyslexic, and he was lucky enough to graduate high school before the exit exam became a graduation requirement. She says that failing this high-stakes test sets off a lifetime of economic ruin for the students.
You're not even eligible to deliver Pepsi cola cartons for the Pepsi company because they require a high school diploma. You can't sell shoes at Sears because Sears requires a high school diploma. Now, maybe Walmart or Kmart will hire you, but they tell us in the personnel departments that they're very reluctant to ever promote someone to higher levels of shift management or whatever without a high school diploma.
The state has already spent $100,000 to study why so many special ed students fail the exam, but that answer has so far eluded researchers. While students continue to fall through the cracks, California is facing $5 billion in education cuts. Senator Gloria Romero says that the state has adopted a culture of serial test-taking.
We can study ourselves into oblivion. We know some basic essentials that are wrong with the high school exit exam as it is applicable to a class of students with constitutional rights and protections.
Rochelle's options in life reduce dramatically if she doesn't get a high school diploma. Before she gets to a four-year university, she'll first have to take a two-year community college route. She'll also have to balance more hours at work because she'll be ineligible for state grants and about 60% of other grants and scholarships. If she did want to just jump into a trade, she'd find that 70% of trade associations offering paid apprenticeship programs wouldn't even consider her.
It kind of makes me upset and feel down and low every time people talk about it. Because, like, out of all my friends, I am, like, it's only, like, three of us that haven't passed it and the rest have. So it is, you know, it's intense.
Advocates for students with disabilities are trying to push an emergency bill through the state legislature to ensure that this year's class of special education students get to graduate. But it's uncertain whether the governor will sign anything that challenges the exit exam.
You don't fall into their trap. And this is what they've done there, set a trap for her.
I don't want to be a dropout, so I got to continue. If I have to go to a two-year college just to transfer, I guess I'm going to have to do that. So I can be successful in life. You just gotta keep motivating yourself or have someone down your throat about it. Hurry up and get out. Get out of high school.
Good morning, Lyra. This is Margaret Boyer, Rochelle's great-grandmother. She passed the language part of the KC test.
For decades, Richmond has been one of the most dangerous cities in California. Many of its young people are at the mercy of the streets. Brittany Johnson introduces us to one Richmond native who uses her personal story as a cautionary tale for those on the verge of changing their lives for better or worse.
This is Dion. And of course, this is Skippy.
It's been more than 25 years since Arlinda Love's only son was shot. She says he was shy, caring, and athletic.
He was really into sports. Really, I used to love going to watch him play baseball, you know. Yeah.
15-year-old Maurice Godfrey was shot in the head while riding in the back of a moped in Richmond. Lev recalls how she felt waiting by his bed as he lay in a coma.
I didn't want to give up. I didn't want to let go. I remember the doctor had asked me if I would donate his organs, and I'm like, well, no, I can't donate them because he's going to live.
But Maurice didn't make it. Guns also claimed the lives of Love's sister Beverly and her nephews Dion and Skippy.
That's your grandpa.
Devastated, she says she turned to alcohol, drugs, and the streets.
And basically, name it, I've done it. Yeah, I saw, you know, mm-hmm. saw crack to a lot of people. Saw PCP to a lot of people.
She spent 10 years in and out of prison for drugs and credit card fraud. But now, her past acts as her most valuable weapon against violence. Love tries to stop violence before it starts. Through a program called Real Choices, she works at San Quentin with inmates who want to turn troubled teens away from a life of crime. Kevin Penn works alongside Love in the program and says, like many of the teens they work with, he grew up thinking that violence was the only way.
Today's youth believe wrong is right, and right, it doesn't exist. It's wrong. You know, their concept, their belief systems are twisted. And I'm to bear for that because I left a legacy behind of doing wrong.
Penn, a former gang member and drug dealer, is serving a life sentence for attempted murder. He gives teenagers tours of San Quentin to show them the true cost of bad behavior.
The whole objective of putting the youngsters in the cell is to make them really just feel the environment, to smell it, to understand how a man like myself can live in something like this for over 20 years. If we're on lockdown, this toilet becomes not just a place to use the bathroom. It becomes my dish, my washer and dryer. It becomes my bathtub. It becomes everything key essential to me surviving in this cell. And we make the kids understand that you never have to do this. You can make a choice outside of this. Most of the people that are in prison, we all share one thing in common. We made some bad choices. Through Real Choices, it's about making right and real choices.
10-4, and what's your 20?
Richmond Lieutenant Mark Gagan says the police need all the help they can get reaching young people who are already exhibiting risky behavior.
Loitering on the corner, 24 hours a day, hanging out on a corner, whether it's 7 in the morning or 7 at night, midnight or noon.
Now you're a juvenile.
Gagan cares more about the social causes of crime than you might expect.
The type of person who's capable of committing murders very easily is somebody who probably never really had a lot of opportunity to get education, structure with any other type of family or friends, you know, somebody who's really sort of lost.
He works in a community ranked the 9th most dangerous in the country. Civic leaders say there is no quick fix. The causes of crime are too deep for law enforcement to penetrate alone.
They can't solve the problem. If they could have solved it, they would have solved it by now.
Reverend Andre Shoemake was raised in Richmond and has delivered more than 20 eulogies for murder victims.
And oftentimes, I would get phone calls when there was a shooting. So I would go out to these homicide scenes and would see, you know, these young African-American men laying out there with their brains blown out, blood pouring out of them. And it was like, well, wait a minute, where's the outrage?
He organized the city's first Black-on-Black Crime Summit in 2005 and was a leader in the Tent City movement, where residents outraged over a deadly crime wave spent 40 days living in tents throughout the city to stem the violence.
The solution lies within the community, and we've got to find ways of strengthening that capacity of the community to solve its problems. Until we do that, we're just whistling in the wind.
Not Today was a 24-hour citywide effort to prove the potential for peace in Richmond. Dozens of churches cleaned up neighborhoods, offered drug counseling, and prayed
God coming together and anything that
all over the city. Shots rang out during the 24-hour event, but no one died. As part of Not Today, Love and other mothers were honored at a banquet for persevering despite their personal losses.
There's no way out. Drugs, alcohol, there's no way out. This is the hand that was dealt to us, mothers like me.
Shoemake, a father himself, says the loss of life and fleeting hope is a losing combination in the city.
In Richmond, I believe the violence is a family problem. Therefore, you got to bring the family together. We got to identify who this son is, this daughter is, this cousin, this nephew, this niece that's out there doing what they're doing. And we got to pull them in.
Where were you yesterday?
Love admits she tried to get her son to follow her in the wrong direction. She asked him to sell drugs.
He said, no, mama. You sell drugs, you go to jail. I don't want to do that. I said, what you want to do? And he said, I want to get married and have kids.
Love says Maurice died with a clean record, but way too soon. Love's experiences as a victim and criminal make her a unique weapon in the war on violence.
This is Skippy's grandson, yeah.
She feels fortunate that she's still here so that she can keep alive for the next generation the memories of the loved ones she's lost.
Thank you, Lord.
Bay Area homicides are on the rise, and with them comes an increase in unsolved deaths. This is the story of two men from different cities and their family's search for justice when local law enforcement doesn't seem to be doing enough. Annabelle Peavy brings us more.
There's a major problem in San Francisco. It's a dangerous place to actually live, and it's a even worse place to die.
According to Sacramento Bee journalist Melissa Nix, the city of peace and love is earning a bad reputation. She says San Francisco makes it easy to literally get away with murder.
The people who we pay to protect and serve us are not doing their job.
For Melissa, it's personal.
I think this is our second date.
Melissa dated French software engineer Hugues de la Plaza for 4 years.
And when Hugues was happy, this is the face that he would make.
By all accounts, Hugues was a successful professional with the Leapfrog company. He had lots of friends and a bright future. But all that changed the night of June 2nd, when his friends and family say he was brutally murdered in this Hayes Valley apartment.
I looked at my phone and I saw that my friend Amy had called. And she said, you know, I'm so sorry, Melissa. I said, what are you sorry about? She's like, I think something's happened to Hugues. And I said, what do you mean? She said, I think he was stabbed to death.
While police said his apartment showed no sign of struggle, neighbors reported hearing footsteps and door slamming.
Hugues had bled all over the apartment. I saw the crime scene photos, and they're like a horror movie. He bled all over the apartment, bled all over the front stoop, and died probably within minutes, according to the coroner.
For friends who loved Hugues, what disturbs them as much as his death is the simple fact that his case has still not been classified as a homicide. Instead, police have suggested that what happened that night was suicide.
It is something you don't do out of the blue suddenly one night and you just stab three times yourself, you know.
Friends Christophe Schumann and Laurent Martineau are outraged by assertions the wounds were self-inflicted. The coroner's report documented 3-inch stab wounds to Hugues' neck, chest, and abdomen. Nevertheless, the lead detective in the case, Antonio Casillas, initially suggested Hugues stabbed himself and then washed off the knife before he died. A knife test later showed no trace of blood. Despite the evidence, after 6 months, the medical examiner officially classified his death as undetermined. This week, police officials confirmed they have not ruled out suicide.
There is no other logical explanation. It's obvious that if there is no weapon, there is no knife, and we're talking about stabbing, and it's 100% sure it's a stabbing, it's 100% sure it was done with a knife, there is no doubt about it, and there are no knives, then it has to be a homicide.
His friends argue the suicide notion is absurd. They say Hugues was happy before he died, with money in the bank and plans to move to Argentina.
The night that Hugues died, he'd actually gotten a promotion that day, and he'd bought himself a new laptop that day.
In February, Melissa testified in front of the police commission, demanding answers.
More than 9 months have passed since Hugues' death, and yet we still await the results of DNA analysis of the blood supposedly taken from the crime scene. Witnesses and contacts have been neglected as well.
Commission President Teresa Sparks told her to write a complaint to Police Deputy David Shin.
Please let us know if you're not getting some results or some information from the department.
So Melissa wrote a 15-page report. 3 weeks later, she was told that because she wasn't family, they couldn't give her any answers.
The police still refuse to call it a homicide. One, because they don't want the statistics. Two, they don't want to actually have to face the fact, to lose face, that they didn't do an adequate investigation to begin with. Three, they just don't want to bother to investigate a homicide that was a pretty difficult one to investigate.
blonde hair.
Melissa has joined forces with Christophe and Laurent to push for an adequate investigation. The French government is equally dissatisfied. A French investigation is already underway, with more officers expected to arrive sometime this summer. Hugues' parents, who don't speak English, have traveled twice now from France looking for help. They say they don't fault the San Francisco police. They just want answers. François de la Plaza agreed to be interviewed, but with a disguised face, because he said he wants to have the upper hand if he is ever to meet the murderer of his only child.
On aura le sentiment que le travail sera fini lorsqu'on connaîtra le nom du meurtrier. C'est tout ce qu'on demande. On s'est aperçu en venant ici que le travail n'était pas très bien fait. Donc on a engagé un détective privé et avec l'enquête que l'on fait nous-mêmes autour des amis, des voisinages comme ça, on essaye de recueillir le maximum d'éléments.
Yeah, Melissa said they've gotten nowhere, so she headed to Sacramento last month for the 19th annual Victims March. Thousands turn out at the Capitol steps every year to honor loved ones and speak against unsolved homicides. In 2005 alone, there were over 2,500 homicides statewide. Less than half of them were cleared. At the rally, Melissa confronted San Francisco District Attorney Kamala Harris about Hugues' case.
I'd like to know what the hell is going on.
You have a right to know what's going on, so I want to help you with that.
I've had to advocate for his murder and for an adequate investigation for 10 months is obscene. It's obscene. And all of these other people out here from San Francisco who have been having to do the same thing, you all should be ashamed of yourselves. It's a systemic problem.
Speak for
the San Francisco
department.
Government has a systemic problem in actually taking care of their citizens.
I cannot speak for other agencies, but I can speak for mine.
I'm holding you accountable. I'm holding you and your agency accountable
so
for looking into this murder.
In the last 4 years, Harris has seen a steady rise in the number of homicides in her city. She admits there's a problem.
In San Francisco, the statistics are challenging. Really, only about 30% of homicides have resulted in an arrest.
What about those who say that the city of San Francisco simply has too few investigators to deal with the number of homicides?
Well, I'm going to leave that to the police chief to give you an assessment of what that means.
The police department wouldn't specifically discuss the case on camera, but Detective Casillas did say resources are a concern. He has 50 to 60 cases currently open, and said that undetermined deaths, like Hugues, often get lowest priority. Treating the violent deaths of young Bay Area men as a low priority is not news to grieving mother Karen Jones. Karen has attended victims' rallies like this one for 2 years. Her family is from Richmond, a city that reported 47 homicides last year, and is ranked in reports as ninth in the U.S.'s 10 most dangerous cities. Like Melissa, for Karen, those statistics are deeply personal. Her 16-year-old son, Jarrell, was shot in broad daylight in 2006 while walking to the store. No suspect has ever been arrested. For Karen, there's only two things that get her through each day.
Just faith, hope.
Karen's been waiting 2.5 years for answers about her son's death, and missing him doesn't get easier.
He always was a very clean person. He kept his shoes lined up in his closet and clothes aren't. I just miss the things that we used to go out and do, like fishing. And my daughter, she don't really fish.
Late last year, Karen was one of three who was granted $50,000 from the governor to use as an award for information leading to the arrest of her son's murderer. She had mixed feelings when she got it.
I was happy, but then, you know, I was sad at the same time. Because it's other people that's in the same situation as me that haven't received nothing. I'm not just only fighting for my son. I'm fighting for the other victims that have, you know, that can't speak.
Okay. For a mother who's used to the stereotypes that Richmond homicides are linked to gangs, Karen doesn't want Jarrell, who she and police say was one of the good guys, to be forgotten.
You know, and everybody know. Because they used to always tell me, you know, slack up some, give them some, you know. I was like, no, I don't think so. I did it when he was here. So why would I stop now?
And for Hugues' friends and family, they don't want his name to go down in the record books as a mystery.
I want to know why someone would kill him. And I want to talk to that person and make him understand how much pain and suffering he's caused Ook's friends and family, and how much of a nightmare it is to live day in, day out, not knowing why someone that you loved was murdered.
Ce qui me console avec Ook, il a vécu 36 ans, mais il a vécu 36 ans parfaitement heureux. C'est ce qui me...
It's not about Ook himself, it's the way the thing is being done is crazy, and Ook is one person, and it could be other people.
Whatever it takes, I just would like, you know, this case to make an example of what should be done in the future for the sake of anyone living in the city.
Forensics from Ook's apartment will be sent to France later this month for analysis. Just one more step, Melissa says, in their never-ending search for answers.
They're hoping that through attrition or through becoming tired, that will go away. But I'm a journalist, and they picked the wrong person and the wrong family to mess with. I'm not going away.
Every day, more than 2 million men and women wake up behind bars in the U.S. prison system. The greatest number are in California's overcrowded prisons, and the state legislature has recently decided to make room for more. Jacob Simas reports on the Public Safety and Prisoner Rehabilitation Act, a bill that promises one thing but does another.
Hello, everybody. Good afternoon. This is truly an important day for public safety in California. As you all know, we have a dangerous overcrowding crisis in our prisons, and the federal courts have threatened us to put a cap on our prison population if we don't get our act together, and that will mean that thousands of criminals will be released early. The legislature and I are determined not to let that happen.
Last spring, the governor announced passage of California's most recent prison spending bill, giving the green light to construction of 53,000 new beds, intended to ease overcrowding and increase rehabilitation services inside state prisons. In California, more than 170,000 inmates now occupy prisons built to accommodate 90,000. The prison spending bill, AB 900, will cost the state $7.4 billion.
Well, AB 900, if implemented, would be the largest prison construction project in the history of the world.
Rose Braz directs the Oakland branch of Critical Resistance. It's an organization committed to ending society's reliance on prisons as an answer to social problems. She's part of a growing coalition working against the prison bill.
When the legislature passed AB 900, they did pass it as a prison reform bill, as a prison rehabilitation bill. Yet, less than 1% of the $7.4 billion that will be borrowed was slated to go to unspecified rehabilitation programs. Less than 1%. AB 900 is a prison expansion bill, and prison expansion is not prison reform.
With California facing a $20 billion deficit, and services like education already facing cuts, I wondered. As a California voter, why hadn't I heard about this bill? And where's the money coming from to pay for it?
Lease revenue bonds. And a lease revenue bond, they were created for revenue-generating projects. Kind of the classic example is a toll bridge. You borrow the money, you build the bridge, and then you collect the tolls and you pay back the debt. So the theory goes that because this is a revenue-generating project, there's not really a constitutional debt that California voters need to approve. The project pays for itself. So in the early 1990s, when voters began to flatly reject prison construction bonds, the legislature, in a bit of a panic, said, how are we going to fund these things? And they created this myth that prisons are revenue-generating projects.
Could such a large amount of taxpayer money be spent without voter approval? I decided to go to Sacramento to find out if it was true. Senator Michael Machado is one of the primary authors of the prison legislation. I asked him to explain the mysterious money trail.
We're going to put somebody and put them into a prison. We got to pay for the clothing, we got to pay for the food, we got to pay for the housing, we got to pay for the medical care.
But is that's cost?
It's cost to the state. But it is revenue to the Department of Corrections. And out of that revenue, they use that to pay for the to repay the bonds. If you're asking me, are the taxpayers at risk? Did they put it up? Yes.
In other words, the $7 billion loops straight back to the prison system, while the taxpayers foot the bill, never having had an opportunity to approve it at the ballot box. But the senator suggested that the money questions are the wrong ones to ask.
You can't look at the prison system in a snapshot and try to respond to it. What we should be putting forward is, what is the optimal population we want in our prisons? Should we have a capacity of 170,000? Or should it be 150, or should it be something else?
While legislators are deciding how much to boost prison capacity, more and more people are being incarcerated. For the first time, one in every 100 adult Americans is behind bars. That's one quarter of the world's prison population. But the issue of growing prisons and lack of rehabilitation goes beyond tax dollars and complicated money trails. I wanted to hear from those who've actually experienced life in prison. So I paid a visit to Medford House, a residential rehab program for parolees in Hayward, California. The program provides food, shelter, drug counseling, and employment for about 30 adult parolees as they attempt to transition back into society.
These guys, although they've got a criminal background now and they have drug and alcohol addiction problems, but you take that out of the picture, they're stand-up people, they're good guys.
I met Ron Doyle, the executive director, and Miss Raynetta Lewis, who manages the day-to-day operations.
This is a ward from Schwarzenegger.
Both have spent time behind bars and understand as well as anyone what it takes to stay out. They explained the link between the lack of parolee services and prison overcrowding.
15, 16, 17 years ago, there was, I think, 7 or 8 prisons
was,
in California. Today, there's 30-something prisons
yeah.
in California. And what makes up that difference in population from 15 years ago to today is the constant multiplication of the recidivism over and over and over and over and over. If they went to prison and got released and got rehabilitated and didn't come back, then there would be not a need for those additional 30 prisons.
Right. It's not the lifers, because they haven't gotten a chance to come home. It's the little drug offenders.
Yes.
It's the little burglars.
Yes.
It's the ones that we can help. Give yes. them some tools so they don't
yes.
have to keep doing that.
Yes.
California prisons have one of the highest recidivism rates in the country at 70%. And California is second only to Texas in rate of incarceration in the country.
They might really want to change and make this his last time. But he was offered no services. He was released again with $200 and said, make this work. Okay, he can't make it work. But if we had 4 or 5 more Medford houses in Alameda County, now he might can make it work.
Although I wasn't able to film the parolees for confidentiality reasons, I was able to speak with Javier Jimenez, a recent graduate now working as a mentor to East Bay youth. He was joined by Norman Thomas, also a graduate and now a counselor in San Francisco. Receiving support and treatment played a huge part in turning around their lives and saving them from a return to the penitentiary.
I was still involved, you know, with the game. You know, I was, selling drugs still. I was under the influence of drugs, and it almost cost me my life on numerous occasions. You know, I didn't trust anything. At that time, my trust and belief system was all blown out of the water. You know, I didn't trust or believe in anything. And so when I came here, I came with a whole different attitude, like I said, and I wanted to absorb everything that they had to offer. It took me a little while, you know what I mean, to get it, you know, but I got it.
I mean, I had tried everything and in every way to make it on the streets doing what I was doing. And the end result, it's like they say in Narcotics Anonymous, is jails, institutions, and death, the way that I was living. That was the end result. I either went to jail, I came close to getting killed on numerous occasions, I've been shot, I've been stabbed, I've been hit by a car. I mean, you name it, it's happened to me. They figure we're hopeless, you know, but me and Javier are two testaments that there is hope for these guys. There is hope. But I don't know any man that's in this facility right now that wouldn't accept some help if it was going to better him.
Everybody needs help once in a while.
But providing the help costs money. Alameda County is home to 5,000 parolees, but only 250 beds are available for them at programs like Medford House.
That ain't enough beds. Excuse my improper English. That's not enough beds to service that type of population.
And if they are lucky enough to get in the door, they'll have only 3 to 6 months at best to receive treatment and get back on their feet. Resources are too slim and waiting lists too long to give them more.
That's the tragic part, is we do have people that would come through here and we know they've been here for 6 months and we're ready to roll them out, and we know you've done the best you can do. But in the back of our hearts, we know you need more than this, but this is all we can give you.
Parolees in Alameda County may not have a bed once they're released from prison, but if AB 900 is implemented, there will be a space for them back behind bars.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.